Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
Hello and welcome to this edition of The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, which is a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to attend one of our worship services. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. And if you don't live in that area and you live in the Medway towns, we meet the first Sunday of each month in Raynham at 3 p.m. Or if you live in Scotland, I also help serve St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, and they meet each Sunday at 11 a.m. I'd like to invite you to those services or go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, find the nearest congregation to where you live, and pay them a visit. I know that you will receive a warm welcome. I'd also like to thank you for your prayers and your financial support of Lutheran Radio. It means so much to us to know that there are people around the world praying for us and helping us out financially carry on this great calling that we have. Again, we invite you to go to our website and look at all of our podcasts and all of the downloads which are available for you to listen to at your leisure, and we encourage you to do so and share them with your friends. Today we're going to continue a conversation that we started last week with Dr. Jeff Leininger. Jeff is a former associate pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in Cambridge, England, while he did his PhD at Cambridge, and he is currently serving as the campus pastor at the University, or Concordia University, Chicago, formerly River Forest. And we are looking at Jeff's main area of research, and that's the English Reformation. We began last week, and we'd like to welcome you back, Jeff. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much, John. I'm really happy to be a part of this and an exciting topic for me.
And for me as well. It's a wonderful chance to learn some new things about stuff I should know, but I appreciate this opportunity. Last week we talked about the Lollards and their influence on laying the groundwork, as it were, for the English Reformation. Could you maybe just give us a quick summary of who the Lollards are, and then we'll carry on with looking at the next segment?
Yes, people think of the Lollards as Protestants before the Reformation, and they are associated most strongly with the teachings and writings and preaching of John Wycliffe, who died in 1384 and was condemned for heresy in 1415. They have a lot of similar teachings of the Protestant Church in terms of its resistance to the traditional Catholic Church and to the papacy, and they arise in places in England where the English Reformation also arose. It is a very difficult to prove exact historical causation between the Lollards and what was happening in the English Reformation, although there certainly are a lot of similarities. And so that is one of the great academic questions, is how influential were the Lollards on the English Reformation? And we can certainly see some correlations, but the actual causations is a bit in doubt in terms of the scholarship.
Well, today we're going to look at the state of the church at the beginning of the 16th century. I'm constantly kind of amazed that when I talk to people about the English Reformation and the history of Christianity in the UK, that, you know, the Anglican Church is really the state church now. It's the church that most people say they belong to. And it comes as a shock to most people that really Henry VIII was a Catholic, and before Henry VIII, England was a Catholic nation. Again, I think this is really good groundwork that we can lay. And so again, can you tell us about the state of the church at that time and the influence of Catholicism just over the life of the common person in the UK?
When we think about what are the antecedents or the groundwork or the setting of the stage for the English Reformation, some people will point to Lollards. The other thing that people might point to is, I'll just use another L, the lethargy of the traditional church, or the decline and decay of the Catholic Church at the time. And this is very much a part of scholarly debate. I think the old view, and this is a view that was quite dominant for a long time, was that the church, the traditional Catholic Church, was completely corrupt and very much hated by the normal common laity. There were oppressive prelates, rampant anti-clericalism, pluralism, that is, the holding of more than one church office, absenteeism, simony, which is the buying and selling of church offices, poorly educated clergy. There was the decline in the monastic foundations. The teachings, certain doctrinal teachings, were immensely unpopular, such as purgatory. And so that's kind of the old view of the English Reformation, was that the church was so corrupt and so out of touch that it just took a short, sharp shock to push the whole thing over. And that short, sharp shock, of course, was Henry VIII's desire to get a divorce from his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, so that he can marry Anne Boleyn. So that's kind of the old view of this this corrupt, dark ages, unwilling to change, completely out of touch with the normal laity. That's a kind of the old view of what you might say, what was the English Catholic Church like in 1500?
Well, Jeff, you say that's the old view, but that sort of implies there's a new view. Are scholars seeing things differently now?
Yes. That the old view, I think, was really written by, you know, history is always written by the winners, right? And that old view of history was really written by English Protestants after the fact, relying a lot on John Fox, who was an English Protestant who wrote the great Book of Martyrs, relying a lot upon his view, which is a very distasteful hatred of the old traditional church. So that old view is Roman Catholic Church is, it's unpopular, it's disgusting, it's imposed. And the Reformation, as I said, was this pushing over the Tower of Babel that was about to fall. But the revisionist view, which I think embrace, and which has been, I think, historically pretty well established now, is a slightly different, well, not a slightly different view, a stronger view of the vibrancy of the traditional medieval piety. Scholars such as Eamon Duffy, who is a Roman Catholic in piety, he sort of heard this view of the English Reformation. It seemed so dissonant from his own view of his Catholic faith growing up. Scholars such as Richard Rex, Scarisbrick, Haig, they began to take a look at this view and really get into historical documents. And they began to push this idea that instead of a Reformation from below popular unrest, that the English Reformation was really a Reformation from above. It was by statute, by propaganda, by enforcement, that those at the top changed the way that people viewed religion. And so they began to look at things like, look for signs of life or vibrancy in the traditional Catholic Church, such as wills. Well, what you find in wills is that the laity are pouring money into the traditional medieval institutions. So that's not a sign of decay. They looked at church buildings. All kinds of churches are being built in the 1500s. They looked at religious publishing. There's all kinds of traditional Catholic piety that's being published. They looked at numbers for the candidates of the priesthood. They found that there were actually more and more people going into the priesthood. And a line from Eamon Duffy is that the laity were profoundly addicted to the old ways. So you can see that this is a much different picture. This is a picture of a traditional church that, though, of course, there was always corruption in churches, but that it had signs of life and that it had some deep connections with the popular piety of the laity.
As I understand it, that may even be shown in the fact of things like pilgrimages. Canterbury and Walsingham seem to have been very popular pilgrimage sites, even for Henry.
That is correct. Yeah, so these revisionist scholars, and this has been broadly very much accepted, have said that the English Reformation was not something that was inevitable. it wasn't something that was bound to happen because of some spark of life or piety in the English people, as if the English have always been Protestants, and this same old view might kind of point to the Lollards and see, there's the Lollards. That's actually the real Englishman. He's a Lollard, and then he's dissatisfied with the Catholic Church, and then finally when the Henry VIII stuff happens, the whole thing sort of unravels. But the revisionist view, which has been commonly accepted now, is really that these traditional Catholic pieties were strongly connected to the people in their heart. They had to work hard to change people's views. And I think actually, John, we could at this point sort of reflect as Lutheran pastors a little bit about this. I think that the gospel is counterintuitive, isn't it? It's not something that we naturally crave. It's something that we have to be taught. It is something that sort of in a way confronts us. And so I think even this kind of more, this new view, this revisionist view of the English Reformation really connects somewhat to our Lutheran theology as well.
And you mentioned about the monks and the monasteries. Can you tell us what role those played in society of the time? Because there were monasteries all over the place.
Yes, that's right. I think some estimates are between 20% and 30% of all of the wealth of England was tied up in these monastic institutions. There, you will always find, you know, criticism. There's always going to be anti-clericalism. I mean, as a Lutheran pastor, you know this, right? You know, you're never going to live your life in ministry if everybody loves you all the time. And so, of course, there's much evidence for people having criticism of their traditional church. But there's also a lot of evidence of people being connected to it and relying upon it. The monastic institutions were considered to be this, in a way, this vortex straight to God. This connection that, you know, a normal peasant or a normal lay person has to be doing worldly things, and the monastic institutions were doing spiritual things. People would give to these institutions. They were relying upon them to do this spiritual work of praying for souls in purgatory, or saying masses for the dead, or saying constant prayers for the king and for the harvest and for the communities. And so I think on balance, you have a lot of not only positive relationships with the monastic institutions, although not without criticism, but that they were part of the social construct that lay people did work. They grew crops. They governed. They did banking. They did the trades. But the monastic institutions had a role, had a spiritual role that was culturally and socially very important. And so I think that that's another bit of evidence that the traditional medieval church had a role to play in society. And when that role changed, it was actually quite disruptive to many people.
So when Henry and Cromwell started closing and the dissolution of the monasteries, was that met with violent reaction by the people, or were they all in favor? Were they the ones going, let's, you know, tear the walls down?
Yes, I mean, there was violent reaction. I mean, we even have the Pilgrimage of Grace in 1536, which was directly linked to the closing of the monasteries. What happens with Cromwell and Henry VIII is that they get very good at, quite plainly, propaganda. They get very good at saying, look at all of this corruption in these places. They also get very good at taking the wealth of the monastic institutions and switching it over to the Protestant nobility. And they also do some good things with them. When they close them, they try to build schools, which they try to do things with for the poor. And so the process of changing, of closing these monastic institutions, they tried to do everything they could to make that change as easy as possible, as welcomed as possible. But there was resistance to it. We know that. It was entire rebellions. But there were also areas where people, you know, willingly took the money. They were, in some senses, well, we can take this monastic institution and we can convert it and change it into something else that might be more useful. And so it's a very much a debate in the scholarly areas about how much these things were received and how much they were welcomed. And I would say on balance that Cromwell and Henry VIII, They do everything they can to make that transition as smooth as possible, though there was certainly a lot of resistance to it.
Now, as I talk to people today, there also is this bewilderment that folks like Henry VIII, the kings and leading politicians, I suppose Thomas More might be another one, were so deeply pious and religious that they find that to be such a strange state. How was their Catholic faith affecting the way they ruled? I mean, we still have in the coins today the FD, the Defender of the Faith, which goes back to Henry for writing his theological treatise against Luther. How did that Roman Catholicism affect how they governed and their daily lives?
Normally with Henry VIII, people think they use the phrase sort of Catholicism without the Pope, which is, I think, fine enough. Like, eventually that's where he gets to. I mean, he has masses said for his soul after he's dead. He, in the end, he maintains a lot of his Catholic piety. I think what's happening in the English Reformation is there's this discovery, I guess, in their mind. And this is why both, you see on both sides of the theological divide, whether it's Thomas More or John Fisher, who are Catholic martyrs, really, of the era, and other people like Tyndale and Cromwell and Robert Barnes, is there's this discovery of the role of the monarch as a godly reformer. They go back to some of the Old Testament pictures. For example, Josiah in the Old Testament, he rediscovers the law of God, the word of God, and he gets rid of superstition and the altars to Baal, right? And so there is this idea that a king could be a reforming king, and that's actually the most important thing that he is supposed to be, is he's supposed to restore true religion. And you can kind of see how both on the Catholic and the Protestant side, how they could both kind of roll with that for a while. Eventually, what happens is that they just can't keep together in terms of their theology. That the doctrine of justification becomes really a dividing point for them. But initially, this idea that the king is actually in charge of religion in the realm rather than the Pope, that's something with both sides can kind of come on board with for a while. Then, of course, with John Fisher and Thomas More, they are eventually executed because they can't accept all of that, and they can't accept the king being in charge of the church in England.
And that is what I often hear from people, is that this had nothing to do with religion. It had everything to do with politics. Firstly, the divorce, so Henry could marry Anne and hopefully have male offspring. And secondly, it had to do with, hey, I've discovered I'm the king. I have this royal appointment, so I don't need the Pope. Is that a fair thing, or is that quite biased in its understanding as well?
I think there's more nuance there than that. I mean, it is clear that the king's matter, the king's great matter, which is this divorce, is running things. And no one, especially me, I don't want to make Henry out into be any kind of saint at all. But there is also this side of him, which is, I don't want to say sincere isn't the right word, but he honestly believes that he has been cursed by God for marrying his brother's wife. I mean, that is a piece of piety that he really believes. And he does come to believe that the role of the king is to bring reform to his land. The primary part of that reform is to remove the Pope from the shores of England. He considers the Pope, you know, that's a foreign power, it's sedition, it's corruption. The primary form of Henry being a reforming king is to expel the Pope. But also, he comes to think that the bringing the Word of God into the language of the people, remember, Henry VIII will require the Bible to be printed and to be put up in every parish of the realm in 1539, the Great Bible. Henry VIII actually brings this about because he believes that, well, if they read the Bible, they'll also be good subjects. If they read the Bible for themselves, they'll see that the king is actually in charge of this land. And so there are some aspects of the Reformation that Henry does embrace. And he does see himself as a reforming king. One scholar, Richard Rex, who was actually my doctoral supervisor in Cambridge, says that Henry is a reforming king in a Hebraic sense. Think about Josiah. Think about Hezekiah, that they're a king that needs to bring true religion to the realm. Now, for Henry, in the end, that doesn't mean jettisoning all of the traditional Catholic piety. He maintains a lot of that, but he does bring reform in terms of expelling the papacy, the vernacular scriptures, the reform of the monastic institutions. And so there are ways of seeing him not simply as a tyrant who wants to get his own way, but also as somebody that is bringing about reform, although on his own terms.
Now, Jeff, it's easy, I think, for me to see, if we take that old view of how the decay and lethargy, as you put it, of the church really led to the English Reformation. But if this revisionist view that you're advocating now and that the scholars are advocating is correct, then how did that? It seems much less likely, much less influential, the lethargy of the church to lead to this desire and want for a reformation. How would you sum up the importance of this this new view on leading to the Reformation?
Yeah, it's, as I said, the revisionist view, which has been broadly accepted, which in general I accept, is just making the point that there's a lot of life, a lot of strength, a lot of vibrancy in the traditional medieval piety, and that when the changes come, it's not that the church wasn't vulnerable. Of course it was vulnerable, obviously, because the English Reformation happened. But I think the broader point is that people had to make it happen. It wasn't a reformation from below that just spontaneously erupted because, you know, everybody is dissatisfied with all of the medieval Catholic institutions. It's something that an elite group of people reading insights from the humanist scholars and from Martin Luther say that this has to change and we have to make this change. Those type of insights get connected to Henry VIII's desire for a divorce, and then Henry VIII's wanting to found his own church because he can't get the divorce from the papacy like he wants. And so I think that a better view is that, was the church vulnerable? Of course it was. But this old view of this tower that was about to fall over is probably not accurate. A better way of looking at it is that the church had a lot of life to it, but it was vulnerable. And it was vulnerable especially by the influence of the humanist scholars and the influence of Luther's writings.
So as we fast forward just a little bit past Edward VI's reign and Mary takes the throne and reverts back to a very fierce Catholicism, how did that transition happen? Were people happy to see that come back? And then when she dies and Elizabeth takes the throne, were people, again, sad to see the Catholic tradition go, or did they embrace the Reformation views at that time?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because as you think about the broad picture of the English Reformation, you have this going back and forth and back and forth. And in the 1530s, the king's matter and the getting of the divorce, and there's very much a Protestant advance. But then in the 1540s, Henry has this reactionary period where he goes back to a more traditional Catholic piety and understanding. Edward VI is a reforming king, very much so, and he purges the traditional religion. But then Mary Tudor, we call Bloody Mary, but Mary Tudor is probably a better way, a more charitable way of talking about her. She very much restores the Catholic faith. And then under Elizabeth I, you have the establishment of Protestant monarchy. So it's going back and forth and back and forth. I think the main point in terms of the Reformation revisionist thought is that under Mary, she is restoring things to the way it had been for centuries. Many people accepted that, and many, many people yearned for it. But you also, by the end of this very tumultuous period, John, you have a certain, also a sense of, boy, we're just going to keep our heads down to see what happens. We have direct quotes and writings from people under Elizabeth who are saying, okay, I've had four different monarchs now, but one religion. And so you get a sense that people are just trying to hold on to see what's going to happen next. I think in general, you can sort of say that there was, you know, maybe half the country was very traditional in their Catholic piety. You have maybe a more minority, maybe 20% that are really wanting the Reformation change to happen. And then you have a large group are just trying to get on with day-to-day life and be Christian, and they're not sure what to think, and they're just holding on until things settle down. So, but I think in terms of the revisionism, I think what is true is that the traditional ways were very strongly entrenched in the hearts and minds of many people, and that when the Protestant Reformation happens in England, people had to make it happen. And they did because they had great convictions about what it was. They had to, if you want to say, they had to evangelize. They had to change people's view of religion, and they did it actually very effectively.
Dr. Jeff Leininger, we thank you for giving us a picture of the church at the beginning of the 16th century and how that helped influence the English Reformation. Now, you mentioned they tried to hang on, so we're going to ask our listeners and yourself to hang on till next week as we continue our topic and we talk about the humanist and the humanist renaissance in the English Reformation. So again, thanks, Jeff, and we'll look forward to talking with you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.